Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining me today on the Class War Battlefield podcast. Please do me the honor of supporting this work that I am doing. I've been doing this work now for free on your behalf for, my God, 11 years. 5, 10, 20, 50. If you can afford it, please do. Cash at me at $CWB Podcast. CWB Podcast. Cash App it. CWB Podcast. Also, hit me up on PayPal. CWB Podcast. All the way across the board, y'all. Help me out. Thank you for donating and enjoy the show.
This isn't how it's supposed to be. You know, growing up, we were told, you know, go to college, get a degree, work to support your family. Here we are. Did that. Now what? Now what?
An increasing number of people on TikTok have been sharing stories of their survival in late-stage capitalist America, and I want to take some time to look at several of these videos and explain why things are still so bad for working Americans despite headlines claiming otherwise. Now, I do want to go back to the woman that we just heard from. She's actually a nurse who went viral for telling her story on TikTok, and here's more from her.
I feel like my husband and I are doing everything right. We both have good jobs. I'm a nurse. I'm a registered nurse. I work full-time. He works full-time. We just got paid this past Friday, right? We paid the mortgage. Bought some groceries. Put some gas in the car. And guys, it is Tuesday. And we have like $200 or $300 to last us until next Friday. Like, we don't live in a big house. We live in a little ranch. It's 1,100 square feet, 3 bedrooms, 1 bath, us and our 2 kids. And like, I don't know what to do. Like, I'm in school full time. I work full time. He works more than full time. He works overtime every week. I don't know what to do. I'm so stressed out.
Now, her story is not uncommon. In fact, 62% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck, and it's now the main living style, as CNBC reports. And 63% of Americans can't afford a $500 emergency, meaning you'll only be able to get by until you fall behind. But if her or her husband gets sick and misses work, or they get a flat tire, or they have some sort of a medical emergency not covered by their insurance, they could fall into poverty. And once you fall into this hole, it's really hard to dig yourself out of it. It goes back to the famous Taizonde tweet. Being poor now just leads to being more poor later. Can't pay to clean your teeth? Next year, pay for a root canal. Can't pay for a new mattress? Next year, pay for back surgery. Can't pay to get that lump checked out? Next year, pay for stage 3 cancer. Poverty charges interest. And that's exactly correct. If you have an unexpected emergency, you might put the cost of that on a credit card or borrow money from a payday lender. And when you do these things, you begin to fall into debt if you don't have the money for these emergency expenses. So we're sold this myth of meritocracy, where if you work really hard, you'll be successful. But that is demonstrably untrue, because even people who are successful by traditional standards are getting by the skin on their teeth. And it shouldn't be that way, right? Now, some people might argue that her, along with everyone else who's living paycheck to paycheck, well, they're at least getting by. And that is good in and of itself. It could always be worse, and that's true. But when you're working a full-time job, you shouldn't just barely get by in the richest country on earth. You should be able to save money Go on vacation. Buy something nice for yourself once in a while. You shouldn't work yourself to death to only perpetually struggle forever. That's cruel. But there are people who did fall behind that aren't even getting by anymore, like that nurse with the bare minimum. And these stories are becoming all too common now as well. Take this 24-year-old TikToker, for example, who went viral documenting her experience being unhoused and living in her car. She gets ready in her car. She has to brush her teeth in a public bathroom. And as you can see, she says that she felt embarrassed when the lady was in there staring at her. And we often hear this myth from conservatives that unhoused people are lazy and they don't want to work. But she's working. She's still unhoused. She just doesn't make enough money to afford a place to stay. And wages aren't keeping up with inflation. And thankfully, inflation has come down, but it's still bad. And the cost of living rises every single year between 1 and 3%. And that's just in a typical year, because rent actually surged 15% during the first 2 years of the pandemic. And now, thankfully, it's increasing at a more stable rate, as the Washington Post points out. But even though the cost of rent is increasing slower, it's still increasing. It increases 1% to 3% every single year, and it's still increasing following that 15% spike. This is why so many people face housing insecurity. Now, just to give you some perspective, here's an ad for homes from the 1950s posted by Reddit user LuckyStrike85. You can buy a two-bedroom, one-bath home for $7,450 with a monthly payment of $47.92, or a three-bedroom, one-bath home for $7,900 with a monthly payment of $49.74. Now, to put that in perspective, the OP points out that that's around $95,000 in today's value. And another user explains, in 1950, the federal minimum wage was 75 cents an hour. That would cover one of these mortgage payments in about a week and a half at 40 hours per week. I live in an apartment making $22 an hour, and the only reason I can manage to cover rent in a similar time frame is that my two roommates and I split the rent. Now, there is a lot of generational animosity, rightfully so, because the boomers who were born into that economy voted it away by supporting neoliberal politicians for decades. And there's this idea that after boomers built up their wealth, they then took away those same opportunities from their children and then lambasted us for not being as successful as them. And they also call us lazy. And honestly, I'm not one to generalize all boomers, but if you know an older person who helped usher in the Reagan Revolution, you largely can thank them for putting us on this current trajectory, at least. But having said that, though, boomers are not monolithic. Not all of them supported Reagan. Not all of them are responsible for this current situation. Many of them are powerless, just as we are. And many of them are actually now suffering as a result of this late-stage capitalist economy that we find ourselves in. And regardless if they supported politicians that replaced their pensions with 401ks or shifted the tax burden off of the rich and onto them, we are now on the cusp of a boomer catastrophe known as the silver tsunami, and this TikTok explains it well.
Baby boomers are becoming homeless, and that's what spending...
Oh, and this is just getting started. I mean, it's even got its own nifty little name. Look at this. The silver tsunami. And what is the silver tsunami, you might ask? The silver tsunami refers to all of the aging boomers that are going to be of retirement age and are not going to be in the workforce. That means that they're not able to live off of anything but their retirement and Medicaid. Some estimates say that there's going to be 10,000 boomers turning 80 every single day. Every single day, there's going to be 10,000 more retired people that need places to live. A lot of them are going to need assisted living with nurses to staff them. And by 2030, 73 million boomers will be of retirement age. And that doesn't mean all of them aren't going to be able to support themselves, but a lot of them are not going to be able to support themselves. And as a growing number of people need long-term care because life expectancy is getting longer and longer, that means that you're going to have more of these people staying in these places longer, meaning that there's going to be more money necessary to take care of them. And if not having enough houses was bad enough, there's a staffing shortage when it comes to nursing, especially for these people. Most nurses do not want senile old people to be sitting there yelling at them to take care of them. They don't get paid enough. They don't deserve that kind of disrespect, and they're just not for it. So not only do we have a lack of housing, we have a lack of nurses, and we have more people than ever reaching an age where they cannot take care of themselves.
So yes, we pick on boomers sometimes, but this shatters the idea that it's just young people suffering from late-stage capitalism. It's just not true. Boomers are suffering as well. And the question is, if this isn't addressed, what happens to all of these old people? Well, many of them will be forced to just keep working until they die. In fact, a Boston College study found that over 50% of working age people won't be able to retire, which means they'll have to just keep working forever. And if they can't work, if they become disabled or senile or too old, well, then many will just become unhoused. And others will have to be taken care of by their family. Now, go back to that first TikTok with the nurse who's living paycheck to paycheck. Imagine having to care for her parents. That's an extra mouth to feed. That's doctor's appointments that they're going to have to take her parents to. It's a bigger strain on families if you have to balance work and school and being a full-time caretaker for your parents too. It's a lot. It's a huge burden, and it doesn't have to be this way. But we were all told if we worked hard and put ourselves through school, and we'd be able to do things, we'd be able to get a job and live the American dream that we were promised. But that's just not true. It's to the point where Americans are being financially punished for even trying to pursue the American dream and better themselves. For example, listen to this TikToker explain the scam that is student debt.
I just checked my student loans because I needed to get the information to someone. And what the f***? I started with $80,000. I have been paying for 10 years. Last year, I paid $6,000 lump sum because that's really the only way to get it low. That took it down to $76,000 after I've been paying for 9 years. The grand total is I have paid $120,000 and I still owe $76,000. How the f*** is this possible? What?
There's just no winning. And finally, after Biden announced that he'd cancel $10,000 to $20,000 of student debt, the Supreme Court took that away from us. And the same rich Congress people who got their PPP loans forgiven, including interest, had the audacity to scold people like her for not being fiscally responsible enough. Now, these are just a couple of examples, but if you zoom out, you begin to see that our entire economy simply does not function well for ordinary Americans, and it hasn't been this way for quite some time. But despite this, we're told the economy is doing amazing. Now, currently, there are some good economic indicators, but that doesn't mean that everyone is doing good. But despite most people not really doing as well as they should be doing, given how much wealth is in this country, presidents still brag about the economy. Trump bragged about the pre-pandemic economy all the time, and Biden is currently doing the same thing. He's bragging about Bidenomics and the economic recovery that he helped usher in. Now, to be clear, he does deserve some credit, but here's why it feels like things are still getting worse despite some changes to economic indicators. Jeff Stein of the Washington Post shared this chart, and as you can see, the people who are more likely to say that the economy is excellent now or good are richer, older, whiter, and they're more male, meaning that not everyone is benefiting from economic gains. In fact, most people are not. And to be fair, this isn't just Biden's fault. The richest 748 Americans saw their collective wealth increase by 77% thanks to Trump's 2017 tax cuts. And Oxfam reports that the richest 1% bagged nearly twice as much wealth as literally everyone on the planet combined during the pandemic. Now, in an op-ed for Jacobin, Matt Brunig explains that working Americans aren't feeling the effects of the economy because Democrats let the pandemic-era policies expire. This includes the child tax credit, the pause on student debt, expanded unemployment benefits, free school lunches, etc. Now, Brunig goes on to explain, what we got out of the Biden administration, legislatively speaking, was a third tranche of COVID stimulus, an infrastructure bill, and a climate bill. There were a few tweaks here and there to welfare, state, and labor market rules, but in general, the problems with those economic policy areas have gone unresolved. This is not because Biden never promised to do things in these areas or because Biden made no effort. Biden supported and urged the taking up of the left's leading labor market reform demand, the Pro-Union Pro Act. He also supported and tried to pass the Build Back Better legislation that would have made changes in various welfare policy areas, including family benefits and home care benefits. But these things did not pass. Under the usual canon of Democratic apologism, the left's disappointment at his failure is not supposed to be waved off by saying, actually, the economy is good, but instead by saying the cause of the failure is a handful of moderates in Congress, not Biden or the Democratic Party writ large. So this is why Bidenomics isn't landing. It feels tone deaf to just say that the economy is doing well when people are still struggling. So you're not going to be able to convince people that the economy is good if they are still living paycheck to paycheck and their condition isn't improving. And there's this misconception that Trump is better on the economy simply because things happened to feel better economically when he was president, but the policies that he put in place greatly exacerbated income and wealth inequality, and the things that Biden tried to put in place to mitigate that were thwarted by Manchin and Sinema. But rather than trying to convince people that the economy is good, I think that Biden needs to be honest. He needs to say that the economy is good, it's getting better, but there's still a lot of suffering going on, and if he's elected for a second term, he's going to try to make it better. Now, there's indications that Democrats are trying to tweak their economic message, since just saying the economy is good hasn't been working. But I mean, if Trump's running on Make America Great Again, Biden should run on Revive the American Dream. That is something that I think could resonate with a lot of people. But until we get a president who is willing to make drastic changes to the economy and actually fight for the changes they're saying they want to make, conditions for working class Americans are only going to continue to deteriorate. And that's what happens when all of the wealth is hoarded by a small group of elites. If you don't change that and redistribute wealth, things like this are going to continue to happen. People will continue to struggle.
A storm is rising against the privileged minority of the earth.
This is why I say it's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody.
This is an NBC News Hotline special report.
We're at a turning point in the history of this nation. We need to stand for freedom. There's an escalating authoritarianism and even a creeping fascism. Freedom is precious. If we don't fight for it, you lose it.
This much is clear.
We must rebel.
This is our country. We have always lived in it. We were happy. Then you came. We have to protect ourselves. We have to save our country. We have to fight for what is ours.
And welcome to this Class War Battlefield podcast episode. I swear I do not intend to do, or I did not intend in 2023 to make this many two-parters, three-parters, four-parters. It just turned out that way. I swear I didn't mean it. That said, this is, as you can see, a second part to episode dedicated to the Professional Left podcast. This one, there will be critiques, but this one is, I think, a little bit more optimistic than the last one. And I want to give Driftglass some credit for allowing that experiment to go on. One that I hope the Professional Left podcast tries to do at least, every quarter of the year, because one, if you listen to the Professional Left podcast, they'll tell you that they talk about politics all the time. They are one of those households where politics and the dream of how to remake society is a living constant within their lives. If only more people in this country was like that, man, would the world change overnight, but it is what it is. We're getting there. If they indeed do, put more of these out next year, I think it would be beneficial, especially for ordinary people like myself and others who are having these conversations periodically and don't necessarily know how to pull people back from the brink of despair. And there's a lot of despair within Generation E. Remember, I do not call them Generation Z. There's a lot of despair within millennials. There's a lot of despair altogether. We are a lost people. This society and its inhabitants wander terribly, and not many, many people not only want to acknowledge it, but want to say that we need a better way of living to get out of that. Now, for some people, it's going to be religion that does that for them. Other people, it's going to have to be spirituality. And some, it's going to be just ethics that rise above the mundane materialism that we have all been forced into buying into. This mundane materialism, which comes out of Keynesianism, was supposed to put forward an economic system that created a decently closed loop where you manufactured things at home, you sold them in your domestic economy, and then you secured the profits and the wealth generated from those sales, you secured those in your country. You didn't allow them to move as freely overseas, thus enabling countries to build stable wealth pools and to develop themselves. Obviously, that's been blown up. At the center of that cycle, though, was the need to consume. This is why we live in this hyperly consumerist society. If you go back 120 years ago, this country was not hyperly consumerist. We were much more almost Catholic, Protestant society where less was more. You didn't have to have too much. Well, again, post-World War II, the idea was to put into effect this consumer-based economy that built wealth. And for about three, maybe four decades, that principle was adhered to. And with the baby boomers' ascension in politics came the end of that. What was it in the Wall Street movie in the late 1980s? Greed, for lack of a better term, is good. So they took advantage of the consumerist concept that was supposed to generate wealth and ground that wealth within the domestic arena, and thus creating wealth pools throughout the domestic arena. And, well, we see what they've done with it. But, remember I started this about our need to escape from that. So there is people who are discussing, you know, how we can best get away from those things and retool the society in a more not only environmentally friendly fashion, but also just altogether a more people-friendly fashion. Note what I said. I said people. I didn't say person. I said people. Because contrary to popular idiot beliefs, and I do mean idiot, we are not individualized. We are not an individualist society. We have rarely been an individualist society. Yes, sure. There were periodically people, individual people, by the way, who did decently great things. But if you actually track who they were, well, they relied on groups of people also. And if it wasn't for groups of people who recorded what they did, you wouldn't know what they did. Because an individual rarely, rarely ever has the capacity to give to the future their accomplishments in a way that is that doesn't reek of entitlement and egotism. So we are not an individualist society. We've never been an individualist society. Wealthy people know that. Everything for them is about networks. I mean, wealthy people tell poor people that this is an individualist society while they themselves practice overt socialism at every turn. It's insane. If you actually studied how most wealthy people work. Now, this is changing with the newer generation because the newer generation is, and I mean this with the utmost respect for a lot of the newer wealthy people, they don't understand the idea of what is false propaganda and what is real life. They really believe that the individualist promotions of their elders are true, and their elders haven't done well to tell them, no, this is not actually true. This is the reality that we're living in. Those elders have fooled this new generation, and it has made this new generation in some aspects monstrous. It has distorted them terribly. I met a guy recently, actually, who is in real estate, and I met him and his, quote, partner, and was fascinated because these guys are young. You know, they're in their early 30s, and they have built a decent size real estate empire of complexes and buildings and yada, yada, yada. They're doing their thing. But 2 seconds of talking to them made me realize that the humans involved in actually paying them the money that they're basing their wealth on are non-entities. The humans involved in living in those properties, renting those properties, are essentially furniture to them that they can shift out depending on who's paying and who isn't. Now, you might say, well, that's smart because they need to make a profit and they need to this and they need to that. As I was told by a friend of mine, and I went and I actually did a little bit of work on this, they were like, well, you know, check out the reviews of some of their properties. And since I knew some of their properties, I did that. And they had raised rents at one of their properties so significantly, nearly $40 in a year. I think it was $35 in a year. So significantly that it basically broke the back of a couple of people who were living there, probably more like 6 or 7, and they had to move. And I thought about that. If you raise your rent $35 every year, you're talking about a $350 raise over the next 10 years. In that particular piece of property they owned, you know, there was rumors that they were originally going to raise it 50, but decided to go with 35. And I think there was some validity to that because the previous year they had risen it by $35. So, and the year before that, they had risen it by 25. So, it looked like they were moving up, you know, putting $10 more every single year, which is insanity. But, as I often do, I'm off on a whole another tangent, and I need to turn this bus around. Because while this is important, I do want to get to Drift Glass and Bluegill, but we are not an individualist society. The more we allow ourselves to think we are an individualist society, the worse things are going to get. And the wealthy who truthfully believe that this is individualism, that they are living a perfect example of individualism, I want to put them on a desert island and see how much individualism helps them. Because that's true individualism. Note what I said. The guy that I met who's in real estate, he has a partner who also works with him in real estate. Is that individualism? They have a staff of people who not only help run their properties, but manage their properties. They own properties in multiple states. And not just on the East Coast where I'm at. So there's literally a group of people. They are showcasing the network in action. And just talking to these folks, I could tell they're individualists. One of them did say to me, and I really thought this was good. He was like, well, you know, the thing that I've learned, because I asked him, what have you learned managing properties? And he said, well, I've learned a lot. And he went through some stuff. And I go, so what have you learned about the people, you know, who rent? And he goes, well, unfortunately, I've learned that people are, and he paused, and he's like, I don't want to say not good, but, you know, they'll try to get one over on you, you know, they'll try to pull one over on you, and unfortunately, you know, I've learned that, you know, and that it's kind of difficult to be in my position and to be kind and nice and yada, 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 but they'll try to pull one over on you. And I let it be because, you know, I've heard this line of thinking before, and I know when a person is convinced of it, then, you know, you're not going to get them off of that track. But as a person who has rented all my life, there are good landlords, there are great landlords, and there are horrible landlords who think they're good. There are also decent landlords who think they're great. And oftentimes, and I'm not saying this is who this person was, but oftentimes the ones that I hear most ready to say, oh, well, people will get one over on you, are usually the decent landlords who think they're great or the horrible landlords who think they're good. So, you know, just something that I noted in that conversation. But back to the reason why I'm doing this episode, because there is a lot to unpack in that hour plus long conversation. Well, technically it was under an hour, but that hour long episode that they put out. And I want to give some good news, though, to Driftglass and Blue Gal. They asked a question, or Driftglass asked a question, about whose mind is going to be changed. Whose mind is going to be changed with all of the promotions, all of the money that's going to be spent promoting Biden? Whose mind is really going to be changed? And I think that's actually a good question. Because we are living in an increasingly segmented, politically segmented country. People say, oh, well, we live in an increasingly polarizing world. No, we're actually not in an increasingly polarizing world, or excuse me, not world, but country, or even a polarizing society. We are in a society that is segmented according to ideology, belief, and truth. Ideology, belief, and truth. Ideology, belief, and truth. Ideology, belief, and truth. Some might even say ideology, philosophy, and truth. But there's definitely three segments within the society. And remember GOPAC. Remember the episode I produced on GOPAC. The idea behind wedge issues was to break apart the community bonds. I just want to put that there for a minute because I don't think people understand that. GOPAC, Newt Gingrich's speech, which I used at the beginning of that episode. That was, I believe it was 2020-308, episode 2020-308. Don't quote me on that, but it is spelled G-O-P-A-C. You can go back in the archives at radio4al.net, and you can find it there, or you can go to WordPress / Class War Battlefield Podcast, and you can look through my archives there, and you could find it. But it's GOPAC, G-O-P-A-C. Newt Gingrich, at the beginning of that episode, talks about wedge issues being helpful in wedging and separating the voter from the Democratic Party. Mind you, obviously Gingrich is a Republican, but mind you, the entire purpose of the GOPAC strategy was to separate voters from the Democratic Party. Then you insert right-wing radio and media during the time period, and the idea was to put out psychologically distorting messages that isolated the voter, not only from the Democratic Party, but from their social networks, which would have moderated their thinking so that they wouldn't have become totally obsessed by the propaganda they were being fed, and thus it would move them in a direction to centralize them into a socializing network, which would help break the not only propaganda that was holding them, but also, and this is key, move them back in alignment with long-held beliefs, which would have likely sent them right back to the Democratic Party. The process is not laid out by Gingrich in that manner, but now that we've seen this playing out for nearly 40 years, because it started in the early 80s, now that we've seen it playing out for 40 years, we can say, or I can say for certain, that this is what happened. This is what happened. They separated the voter, poured into their lives conservative media, which it's funny how so many conservatives still claim to not be the mainstream when they're everywhere. They're everywhere. Literally, they are the only networks with models on cable that pay them with every subscription. No leftist media is even close to that. Fox couldn't survive if it wasn't for that model. Newsmax couldn't survive if it wasn't for that model. They are the mainstream. They are the mainstream media. Conservative media is the mainstream. And it's always been. It's always been. Its job is to take those isolated people and to make them increasingly so. Fold them in on themselves, which makes them more, unfortunately, delusional. The goal is then to snap that delusion, bring them back to earth, and re-socialize them. I remember Chris Hedges talking about that. Well, here's the thing. That is actually happening. Now, it's not happening with the older generation. Not much. But it is happening with the younger generation. Listening to shows like The Majority Report, I get to hear stories periodically, and I hope they do more of them in the future, or at least people call in and let them know that, look, this is, you know, you helped me do this. But I get to hear stories of especially young people, typically under the age of 30, who call in and say, look, I went down the rabbit hole. I went down right-wing craziness, and it was partially your show or Michael Brooks, rest in peace, Michael Brooks, who's a person who I haven't got a chance to mention on this podcast since 2019 or maybe even early 2020. But either way, they'll call in and say, you know, it's your show, Michael Brooks' show, maybe another progressive show that pulled them back and broke the illusion and started them down the path of realigning with reality and thus being able to reassess what they're going through. After 40 years of dumping horrible propaganda onto this society, conservatism is finally seeing a generation who is capable of not only withstanding their barrage, but breaking their barrage and shattering it upon the ground. And that is the great news. That's the great news. Long time ago, I figured out something when it comes to Generation E. Generation E is a generation who seems to be, on the one hand, ready to live out a similar life as their parents. Neil Howe was talking about this recently on one of the interviews I watched with him. But on the other hand, they are very committed to breaking the trauma cycles, to breaking the mistake cycles, the intergenerational cycles that are damaging not only themselves, their families, their communities, but this country. Often that goes unexpressed. It goes unsaid, but I see it daily. I've been talking with people about personal problems in their lives for, you know, decades now. I mean, this goes back to when I was a teenager, but definitely for like the last 15 or so years. And over the last 12 years, 10 to 12 years, I have seen a unconscious shift within the people I talk to towards not repeating the same mistakes as their parents, their grandparents, and the like. And at first, that shift was slight. You could kind of barely see it, or I could kind of barely see it in the rhetoric, the speech, the interpretation of actions of other people. But now, it's down to the point where they are literally saying it without saying it. They are literally saying it without saying it, but you can see it in their actions. In fact, I view the protests, especially by young people, and the overwhelming support towards Palestine at this moment in time, I view it as a collective cosmic statement saying we are done producing the trauma that our parents have allowed to exist, or our grandparents have allowed to exist. We see the truth of the situation, and we are shattering that trauma onto the ground, breaking it so that it can never be reassembled. And it's working. The fear of young people asserting themselves in a manner that doesn't repeat the traumas of the past shakes to the core the institutions that rely on that trauma for their own validity. This is one of the central pillars that gives me hope. They are within themselves a learned generation. They understand, though they may not be able to communicate it, though they may not have the knowledge to communicate it, they understand the problems of the world have been created and sustained through the continued mishaps in humanity. In other words, the minds are changing. Now, as I pointed out in the first part of this, the Democratic Party has put itself into a very bad position. And it has put itself in a very bad position, not because people didn't want to support it. It put itself in that bad position because of its own incompetence and relying on decades-old policy decisions that are not only rooted in unequal and unfair treatment, but is also rooted in trauma from the past. Notice we keep coming back to that. This generation isn't going to tolerate that. They're sick of the hypocrisy. And so the Democratic Party needs to quickly shift from being a party of talking about doing things and being about it. There was once upon a time when the Democrats could use, oh, well, we're a big tent as an excuse. But yet they could say, we are still a left of center party, while they were promoting right-wing concepts. Now, Bill Clinton is probably the greatest example of a possible left-of-center politician who embraced right-of-center logic and went that way and actually made it work on some levels. He was actually a pretty terrible president for most black people, though, but he was able to walk that line because that line wasn't it wasn't blurred by 30, 40 years of evidence which said that line didn't work. Well, now we're to a point where we see that line don't work. We see that line don't work. And the Democratic Party refuses to acknowledge that that line won't work. The fact is this. This is the critical part of the episode. Fascism rides in to a country on despair or on greed. On despair or greed. And with greed, yes, I am counting the desire for power. The masses will vote in fascism because the democratic institutions have fumbled and played around for so long that their legitimacy is doubted. Now, yes, propaganda feeds into that. So, yes, what the Republicans are doing, which, by the way, they have been delegitimizing democratic institutions since Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan wasn't necessarily delegitimizing them, but a lot of the media figures that were hardcore fascistic, I'm sorry, neoconservative, and people who still think there's a difference between neocon and a fascist, I got news for you. You are under delusion. But the hardcore neoconservative, corporatist, fascist radio host back in the late 80s, early 90s, they were promoting the delegitimizing of democratic institutions. It has taken 30 plus years of saying that this society doesn't have real democratic institutions for people to believe it. And so you have a society that wants to believe that voting works, but at the same time, they have been told it doesn't. The problem with a party like the Democratic Party is they still think this is the early to mid to late 90s, where if they talk about forming consensus around things that aren't helping people directly, or they choose to come out and say, look, this is actually what's going on, X, Y, and Z, and actually strike the second one, because that's not going to work here. But the first one, you know, if they form these milquetoast, you know, water thin solutions to major problems, people see them as irrelevant. Even one of the reasons I don't believe Joe Biden has gotten the credit he deserves for Build Back Better is because of Joe Manchin. But nobody knows Joe Manchin outside of West Virginia and policy people. Joe Manchin's name is Joe, just as Joe Biden's name is Joe. So if you say Joe and you say Joe Manchin, a lot of people are just going to hear Joe Biden. Joe Biden couldn't get it done. He couldn't get $7 trillion for infrastructure, for Build Back Better. By the way, a plan most people supported. Incredible amounts of people supported when they did polling on. What did the Democrats say? This is a once-in-a-generation investment. You dummies. You wonder why people aren't enthusiastic about the Democratic Party? Instead of coming back and saying, this is a down payment for what we should have been doing for the last 20 years, they come through and say, this is a once-in-a-generation investment. In other words, they aren't reading the public right, but that's what it is. Parties like the Democratic Party, and notice I didn't say the Democrat Party, I said the Democratic Party, because what the Republicans have done over the last 40 years is they want to be called Republicans because they are part of the Republican tradition of America, but they don't want the Democratic Party to be called the Democratic Party, because then people will free associate Democratic Party with the Democratic tradition, which people have been fighting for in this society for years. So they separate the two, because calling the Democratic members Democratic would say, oh wait, they're fighting for Democratic values, which is democracy. Whereas the Republicans are fighting for Republican values, which is not democracy. I keep telling y'all, Republicanism isn't democracy. Anyway, the Democratic Party, and I know I'm going to slip off on that for a while because I've had 25, 30 years of programming that I got to undo, but a party like the Democratic Party as it is now constituted, and yes, Joe Biden has been a great president. He's done better than most people expected him to do. He has done well. He's a good manager. And if he's reelected, I think he's going to do even better, and he's going to do greater things, at least I'm hoping. But the problem with how the Democratic Party is currently set up is the Blue Dogs and the conservatives still have way too much say. In historical texts, it is parties like the Democrats that welcome the fascists through their inability to govern the way people need them to govern. Need them to govern. Need them to govern. Which is much more left than the Democratic Party has been willing to go in the last 20 plus years. In essence, what Joe Biden needs to be doing in 2024 is saying, you reelect me, we're going to rebuild the New Deal. That's what he needs to be doing. Now, in that episode from Professional Left Podcast, Drift Class talked lengthily talked at great lengths about the friendly fire that the left, I'm sorry, the Democratic, the Democratic Party's base likes to engage in, or even the media likes to engage in with the Democratic Party, basically, as he put it, crapping on the party at every turn. They're not left enough. For the mainstream media has been totally compromised. You gotta expect that. They're not your friends, as you know, the professional left keeps saying. They're not going to be your friends. But when it comes to a lot of the people saying the Democratic Party isn't left enough, I think here is a moment where I gotta talk about generational differences. And while I am absolutely where Driftglass is with Trump is an existential threat, the GOP is gearing up to implement fascism, so we got to stop them at all costs, no matter if we agree with Joe Biden or Kamala Harris or the Democratic Party, we just need to put them all in. We need to make sure that the Democrats take the House of Representatives, and if possible, and I still believe it's possible, many people don't, but I believe it's possible, make sure that they at least get a tie in the Senate. So thus the Democrats have actual power in all three branches. I am on that train. But studying Dr. King for the last 13, 14, 15 years has taught me to see outside of what train I'm on. My generation has had a Democratic Party tell us all kinds of lies. They have. They've looked us dead in the face and told us all kinds of lies. Because of that, they're not trusted anymore. They're not. And this makes a lot of sense. We weren't showing up as it was. We elected Barack Obama to be a left-of-center politician. He gets into office, and he immediately starts doing what Democrats of the 1990s did. Track to the right, track to the right, track to the right, track to the right. And it broke something in us. With what happened in 2015 and 16 with the primaries and the shenanigans that went on behind the scenes to help Hillary Clinton beat Bernie Sanders, it opened a wound that had just started closing. To say nothing about the mistakes of Obama in office and yada, yada, yada. You are dealing with a generation, my generation, in crises presently. Most of us aren't following the details the way we should be following them. That's just the case. Additionally to that, we are tired of a Democratic Party that wants our votes, but wants us to vote for them under pretext of lies. That's what they're fighting against, the Democratic Party. Don't forget. And I think this lives rent-free, as some say, in the minds of my generation. In 2006, my generation, people forget about this, my generation, we were in our late teens, you're talking, you know, 16, 17, 18, 19, and we were in our early 20s, 20 to 25, when September 11th happened, we signed up to go and fight terrorism. We were, in many instances, on the front lines when Baghdad fell. And we were there when the lies were being exposed. And we came home and we worked our butts off to get Kerry Edwards elected. In 2006, we didn't show up in tremendous amounts of numbers, but we were still there. And when the Democratic Party took over the House and I think the Senate, and they said they were going to move to the left, and they didn't, a lot of people were soured by that. But you know something? We got over that because we needed to get the Republicans out and get the Democrats in, and that was what 2008 was about. That failure of 2008 through 2010 still lives with us. And I know it's like, well, get over it, man. It's been, again, you're talking to a generation in crisis. We are rooted deep in trauma. We're trying to get over it. We're trying to get past it. But it's still there. Now, here's the ultimate good news. I believe there's going to be a surprise next year. Particularly this time next year. I believe young people are going to show up. I believe my generation's going to show up because we get it. The presence of people protesting and holding to account their elected officials, even out in public. And by the way, this all has to do with Palestine. But this shows that there is an awakening that is deeper than anything we've seen before happening in this country. People see much more clearer than they did prior to Trump. I believe there's going to be a surprise next year. And that surprise is going to be, not only will Joe Biden and Kamala Harris be reelected, the Democrats are going to take the House of Representatives, but I believe the Democrats may are in a good, no, actually forget it. They're going to take back the Senate. Maybe by one or two votes. They're going to do it. And you know why? Because at the end of the day, the people who are going to vote for your Cornel Wests and your JFK Juniors and those people weren't going to vote for the Democrats or the Republicans anyway. Most of them would have sat home. They're presently trying to, conservatives are executing a plan and a strategy. And I mean, Cenk Uygur's doing this too, but he's not a conservative. Where they're really trying to penetrate into black media. And they're promoting candidates like Cornell, like JFK Jr. Because they want to decrease the number of black people voting. Well, it ain't going to work. It won't work. And you know why? Because black people are conservative by nature. But they're not stupid. They're not crazy conservative. They're not fascist conservative. Sure, you're going to find some. But don't forget, there were black people on plantations who thought that slavery was a natural condition and it was good enough for all black people to be enslaved. You're going to find those turncoats. We deal with them in the community too. And there's going to come a day where they're going to have to come back to the community, and we going to deal with them then, too. I ain't talking violence, because you know, things don't have to always be violence. I know that's how white people think. But things don't have to be violent. You deal with them the way that you deal with any scoundrel. And I'll leave it at that. Because you ain't, you know, you Don't gotta know it all. But there's going to be a surprise. Even with how things look now, there's going to be a surprise. And at the end of next year, we're going to be getting ready for a second Biden-Harris administration. The Democrats are going to have the House. They're going to have the Senate. And what else? What else? You see, because even though the Republicans are going to pull out all the stops for this election, the people are going to stop them because they can't pull the people out. They're going to try, but they can't. I want to thank y'all for listening today. A little bit of a rambler. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, you know you can always reach out to me. Radio4AIL.net. You can also catch me on WordPress /Class War Battlefield Podcast. Catch Class War Battlefield Podcast anywhere you get your podcasts, including Spotify, Amazon, and some other places too. Big up to Dr. Obed Shaka. And obviously to the Professional Left Podcast, the best podcast you are not listening to, but you should be. Democracy Now, obviously. Democracy Now got a shout out from Keith Olbermann. Democracy Now got a shout out from Keith Olbermann. I mean, okay, sure, he's not on MSNBC anymore. He's not pulling down, you know, however many people he was pulling down when he was on Countdown on MSNBC. But that's still huge for me because I'm a big fan of Countdown with Keith Olbermann. Don't miss an episode. The fact that he recognizes the importance of Democracy Now! Is phenomenal. Is phenomenal. Because as a traditional newscaster, he could easily just stay on the track of traditional news. But he's opening himself up. He also shouted out ProPublica, which obviously the mainstream media loves ProPublica, but Democracy Now! Is all right. Now if we can just get him to, you know, catch a couple of other places like Truth Out and things like that. Tom's Dispatch and Democratic Underground and a couple of other places, you know. Think he would find that interesting. He should also subscribe to Tom Hartman's newsletter, which is just freaking phenomenal. Oh, so good. So good. So, if you want a more complete list of shows that you could listen to yourself, go to my WordPress. It'll be... You know, click into any episode and you're going to see a pinned entry. That's the complete list. I am your brother, Vimeri Diesel Gaia. Oh, and if you want to support the show, CWB Podcast, CWB Podcast, PayPal, Cash App. I'm putting on hiatus. I haven't had too many suitors for my Patreon. So I think I'm going to drop my Patreon page and just publish the series that I had started for my Patreon. Just publish it outright. But, I'll think about starting that back up next year. I am Vimeri Diesel Gaia. And I've been waiting for something to happen. Or a week or a month or a year. Peace, y'all. Till next one. There's a shadow on the faces of the men who sent the guns to the wars that are fought in places where their business interest runs. On the radio, talk shows, and the TV, you hear one thing again and again. How the USA stands for freedom. And we come to the aid of a friend. But who are the ones that we call our friends? These governments killing their own. Or the people who find they can't take anymore. And they pick up a gun or a brick or a stone. And there are